Hi, I'm Dennis O'Hare. In my career, I've been cast as a vampire, a cannibal, a serial killer, and various other creepy guys you'd cross the street to get away from. Now that I think about it, why is that? What is it about me that has my agent sending me out for these parts? I think I'm a nice guy. I help old ladies across the street. I even said yes when Selected Shorts asked me to thank their podcast sponsor, Zabars, and Zabars.com. Zabars and Zabars.com sell over 8,000 pounds of freshly roasted coffee each week and also have New York toasting bagels, smoked salmon, caviar, and babka. And Zabars delivers throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. Listeners can find out about exclusive offers and free shipping and can get a free story download at Zabars.com/shorts. See there? Only a really nice guy would do something so selfless.
Hi, I'm Dan Kennedy. Selected Shorts is supported by Amazon Publishing, offering my new novel, American Spirit. Matthew is a 40-something media executive at the end of his job, his marriage, and his health. There's nothing left to do but head out on the road and work up some honest-to-God American spirit, even if it feels like it's going to kill him. It's a dark comedy. American Spirit is available now.
Her appearance may vary greatly depending upon various strange, unknowable factors such as the weather, what she had eaten that day, and what she happens to be wearing, etc. When she is not a cloud of white smoke, Eleanor is a first-grade school teacher who is greatly loved by her students as well as almost everybody else, including strangers who pass her on the street.
This week on Selected Shorts, Clouds, and stories by Sherman Alexie.
Between their tribal lands flowed the Columbia River, the fourth largest in the United States. And during their 7 years of courtship, he'd drive his car onto the Gifford Ferry and cross the water for her. Oh, he'd loved that river since his birth. Oh, he'd loved her since the first time he'd seen her shawl dancing in the powwow twilight.
I'm Jane Curtin, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI, the program that brings you great short fiction read live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. On this program, we look at complicated relationships. Or maybe it's relationships that complicate everything. The writer Sherman Alexie is a longtime friend of Selected Shorts, and from time to time he comes east from his home in Washington State to host an evening at Symphony Space. From one of those evenings, here's his story, Scenes from a Life, performed by Cynthia Nixon.
31 years ago, just after I'd graduated from college, I had sex with a teenage Indian boy. I was 23, and the boy was 17. In the state of Washington, the age of consent is 16, but since I was more than 5 years older than him and in a supervisory position, I was guilty of sexual misconduct, though my crime was never discovered. I don't think I was a predator. It was only the third time I'd slept with somebody, but the boy told me he'd already had sex with 12 different girls. I'm a champion powwow fancy dancer, he said, and fancy dancers are the rock stars of the Indian world. We have groupies. Please don't think I'm trying to justify my actions, but I'm fairly certain that I didn't hurt that Indian boy, either physically or spiritually. At least I hope he remembers me with more fondness than pain. I was a middle-class white girl who'd volunteered to spend a summer on an Indian reservation, any Indian reservation. I foolishly thought that Indians needed my help. I was arrogant enough to think they deserved my help. My Indian boy was poor and learning disabled, and he could barely read. But he was gorgeous and strong and kind and covered his mouth when he laughed as if he were embarrassed to be enjoying the world. I was slender and pretty and eager to lift him out of poverty and so ready to save his life but ended up naked in a wheat field with him. The sex didn't last long and I cried afterward. Your skin is so pretty and pale, he said. Thank you for letting me touch you. He was a sweet and poetic boy for someone so young. We held each other tightly and didn't let go, even as the ants crawled on us. "It's okay," he said. "They won't bite us." And they didn't. I'm not a Catholic, but I would still like to make this official confession. I feel great shame for what I did to that boy. But do you know what makes it worse? I don't remember his name. 3 years ago, I was living in a pre-furnished corporate apartment in Phoenix, Arizona. You've heard of the company I work for. You probably own many of its products. It was July, and the sand invaded my apartment and car and mouth. All day long, I swigged and gargled water to clean the grit from between my teeth. My coworkers didn't get sand in their teeth, so they thought I was imagining it. They teased me and wondered if the heat was driving me crazy. I wondered if they were correct. I was born and grew up on Washington's Olympic Peninsula between a rainforest and a saltwater strait. My parents loved the place so much that they named me Blue Grouse, a bird only found in our rainforest. Lucky me. So, of course, as soon as I turned 18, I legally changed my first name to Melissa, the second most common one in the United States that year. In partial honor of my parents, I did keep Blue, but lopped off Grouse, as my middle name. In any event, a woman originally named for a slug-eating bird doesn't belong in the desert. One morning in late July, the temperature was already over 100 degrees at dawn. And minute by minute, it was only getting hotter. I could have hidden in the air-conditioned apartment, but I'd felt the need to challenge myself. I wanted to see how long I could endure the heat. I was dizzy after a few minutes, and I was so thirsty that everything, the buildings, cars, and mountains, glistened like bottles of water. And then I saw it. To the east of the city, and approaching fast, a massive wave of sand. It stretched hundreds of feet into the air, and it was at least 30 miles wide. All around me, my neighbors, none of whom I knew, but who must have been watching the morning news, had stepped out on their decks to stare. "What is that?" one neighbor shouted to nobody in particular. "A haboob," somebody else shouted. "What's a haboob?" "It's Arabic." "Okay, it's Arabic, but what does it mean?" "The rough translation is big f***ing sandstorm." As it rolled closer, the haboob swallowed the city. I wondered if it was strong enough to destroy buildings. Could the sand be propelled with such force that it stripped metal from cars and skin from humans? I imagined that a million people, sudden skeletons, were buried and would remain so until an archaeologist discovered them centuries from now. My neighbors fled back into their apartments, but I remained on my deck and waited for the storm. I welcomed it. But as the wind blew down power lines and exploded a few transformers, I was forced to retreat and watch the storm through the sliding glass door until a fine layer of dust obscured my view. Later, after the skies had cleared and the electricity had been restored and the mayor had announced that the city had sustained only minor damage, I remained in my dark apartment and stared at the sliding door. The dust had rearranged itself into ambiguous shapes and lines. It seemed to have formed letters of a strange alphabet. I wondered if God was punishing me by sending a message that I couldn't read. I've been a member of 11 book clubs in the last 20 years. I've read approximately 100 novels during that time, and I've enjoyed maybe half of them. While reading books, I write notes in the page margins, and I circle and memorize certain lines and passages. The people in each book might be different, but the plot line is basically the same. Somebody is unhappy, and they do dangerous and foolish things trying to become happy. I've been married and divorced twice. No kids. I'm quite positive that I'll marry and divorce the next man who whispers my name. Like I said, dangerous and foolish. In my 30s, I made documentaries. Or rather, I was the script supervisor for many documentary filmmakers. I kept things organized. I kept track of camera angles, dialogue errors, and continuity. If an actor picked up an apple in the first take, then I made sure she picked up an apple in each subsequent take. In the old days, they called them script girls. These days, the script supervisors are still mostly women, but nobody comments on that. Not allowed. I didn't get paid much, but I enjoyed the privilege of traveling the country. One autumn, I worked with a director making a short film about cranberry bogs in Wisconsin. He was a soft-spoken white man, and he spent most of his time and budget interviewing the Indians who worked the bogs. What is the magic in cranberries? He asked the Indians again and again. And they'd laugh at him. Or they'd say, "There's nothing magical. It's just a good job if you don't mind getting wet." One old Indian woman said, "Aren't cranberries supposed to muscle up your bladder so you pee good?" The director, desperately hoping for a new answer, would rephrase his question in a dozen different ways. In bed, after good sex, he'd stare at the ceiling and chastise the Indians and himself. "They don't trust me," he said. "I'm just another white guy with a camera. If I were an Indian, I wouldn't trust me. Do you trust me?" "Of course not," I said. He was married and had 3 kids. I've never understood why mistresses fall in love with their married lovers. And I really don't understand those mistresses who steal away husbands from their wives and children. Why would you want to destroy marriages and families and friendships? I've always thought the hottest thing about affairs was the secrecy. "But I know these Indians think cranberries are magical," the director said. "They just don't want to share the magic. But I respect the magic. I want the world to respect the magic." He was a calm and kind man. He never lost his temper. But he so desperately wanted the Indians to answer his questions with spiritual force. He wanted the Indians to think of themselves as more than just blue-collar workers. But they were blue-collar workers. And they were strong and scarred. And many of them made passes at me. I was tempted by a few of them, especially this muscular man with long black braids. His skinny butt looked great in his Wrangler jeans. But I politely declined all offers because I knew I couldn't hop into bed with an Indian man without thinking of that Indian boy from my past. Even though I'm what the prigs would call promiscuous, I believe in making love to one man at a time. I didn't want to have a threesome with a real person and a ghost. On the last day of shooting, the director gathered up all of the Indian bog workers, a few dozen men and women, and organized them for a group shot. Just as he was about to film them waist deep in a bog, they started laughing. No, they were giggling, and that made me giggle too. I don't think there's anything funnier than a crowd of big Indians giggling so hard that they cry. The director didn't understand what was happening. I'm not sure I understood. "What's so funny?" the director asked. One of the Indians, a woman, stopped giggling long enough to speak. "We're laughing," she said, "because white people always want to take photos of Indians. But you're taking a photo of us at work. It might be the first photo ever taken of Indians working." And then she and the others laughed. They laughed so hard that the director realized he was finally capturing a spontaneous moment. He filmed the Indians laughing and slapping one another on the backs and shoulders. He filmed the Indians as they grew weak-kneed and weak-backed from laughter. He filmed them as one by one they had to flee the bog to avoid drowning due to hilarity. He kept filming until the only Indian left was that sexy guy with the long braids. He hadn't laughed as hard as the others, but he was smiling with all of his teeth. I lived with my second husband in Malibu. One August, we stood on the roof of our house and fought a wildfire with garden hoses. Can you believe the madness? All my life, I'd promised myself that I would never become the kind of person who'd risk her life for material possessions. Houses can be rebuilt. Your entire f***ing life can be rebuilt if you don't die first. I'm not even sure that I love that house or that husband. We'd gotten married with the agreement that it would be open. We had explicit and implicit permission to pursue sexual partners outside of our marriage. The only rule, don't fall in love. But how could such a rule ever be enforced? How could anybody make such an unrealistic promise? In any case, our open marriage was only slightly ajar. Despite all his best efforts, my husband had only gone to bed with an older woman from work. She was a talkative lady who was bad with money and couldn't retire, so she'd have to keep answering phones until the moment she died. And while I could have sex with many men, every woman can have all the men she wants if she lowers her standards a bit. I'd only made out with three guys while dancing in crowded bars. It wasn't fun. And it was with great relief that we closed the marriage. Hell, we slammed it shut. So newly faithful, my second husband and I defeated a wildfire. We won. We saved our house, our barn, our three horses. 3 months later, my husband left me for that near elderly receptionist. She was 60, and he was 42. I was happy for him, and I was especially happy for her. Old men always have young girlfriends, but how often does an old woman land a young guy? And my husband was rich, too. That elderly receptionist was living in a goddamn fairy tale. How could I not be happy with that romance? We conjured up a no-fault divorce, and my dear husband honored the prenuptial agreement. He kept the horses, I kept the house. My first husband died in a motorcycle wreck. We lived in a state that didn't require helmets, so he split open his skull on the windshield of a Toyota Corolla. I loved him so much that 20 years later, I still keep a photo of him in my wallet. I don't talk about him with anybody. Though I'll dance with almost any man in a crowd, I prefer to grieve alone. I've slept with 32 men in my life. I suppose that's a high number. My male friends give me high fives for my carnal productivity, but my female friends think it's too many. You're just trying to fill up all the emptiness inside you, said my best friend. You're just trying to not be lonely. You're right, I said. But I fail to see why feeling that way should prevent me from trying not to feel that way. I remember all of my lovers' names. I write them down in a book with the Titanic painted on the cover. But on the front page, I've only sketched a nameless portrait of that Indian boy fancy dancer who made love to me in a wheat field that had been left fallow that season. On my computer, the bathroom mirror, the front door, and the refrigerator are sticky notes that share the same message. I'll respect your various hungers if you respect mine. 266 days after I had sex with that Indian boy, I gave birth to our daughter. Who's the father? My parents asked me. I'm not going to tell you, I said. I never held my baby. I didn't want to touch her. I thought it would hurt too much. So they took her away before I could change my mind about the adoption. It was my choice to give her away. I felt that I deserved the punishment. I needed to serve a lifetime sentence in a jail of my own making. My daughter was black of hair and brown of skin. It was strange to see such a dark shadow slide out of my white body. Strangers adopted and raised my daughter. I don't know her history. Sometimes I think about searching for her. In this internet age, with its invasions of privacy and wholesale distribution of all the information in the world, I would guess it's easy to find people, especially those who have no reason to hide. My daughter would be 31 now. I'm sure she is dark, pretty, and slender. I wonder if she, like her father, covers her mouth when she laughs. I wonder if I would recognize her if I saw her on the street. "Hey," I'd say. "It's you. It's you. I always knew I'd find you. I always knew I'd recognize you." But I never see her. Or rather, I always see her. Every other woman in Los Angeles is dark, slender, and pretty. And it seems like half of them cover their mouths when they laugh. I sometimes stop these women and ask them if they recognize me. I love it when they take me seriously and study my face. But they always smile with regret and rue and say, "I'm sorry, but I don't know you."
Cynthia Nixon performed Sherman Alexie's Scenes from a Life. I'm Jane Curtin. Next, another short work of Sherman's, The Vow. This brief, poignant glimpse of a long marriage is performed by Amber Tamblyn.
"If I get Alzheimer's," he said, "then I want you to put me in a home." "Indians don't get Alzheimer's," she said. "Why not?" "Because our elders continue to be an active part of our culture with powwows and storytelling and ceremonies." "That sounds very anecdotal," he said. "And also, you know, like bullshit." "It sounds true," is what it sounds like. "Everything sounds true if you say it enough." "Well, it's true for me," she said. "If you get Alzheimer's, I'm going to take care of you. I'll turn the dining room into a hospital room. I'll get one of those recliners that you can raise and lower, and I'll spoon feed you sweet potatoes." "I hate sweet potatoes," he said. "Okay, carrots then." "Why would you take care of me like that? Why would you sacrifice your health for mine?" "Oh, a thing called wedding vows," she said. "Perhaps you remember ours." We need wedding vows 2.0, he said. "Oh, how very modern of you." "I'm an Indian man," he said. "You know, I'm going to get sick before you do. If one of us gets Alzheimer's, it's going to be me." "Oh, self-pity is so sexy." "No, really," he said, and took her hand. "Promise me." "Promise you what?" "Promise me you'll put me in a home if I get Alzheimer's." "I'm not going to do that." "You're still going to be you." I can't be me if I don't have my memories. We're made of memories, damn it. She was not surprised by his sudden anger. And she knew how to mollify him. "Okay," she said. "You'll lose your memories. I understand. But I'll still have mine. I'll have enough memory for both of us." That's beautiful," he said. "And also, you know, more bullshit." "Maybe. But it's my bullshit." "Listen," he said, just make this promise. When I forget your name, when I forget who you are, then you have to put me in a home. She tried to picture it. She imagined him staring at her like she was an intruder in their home. It was a terrifying hypothetical, but it felt so possible that she was startled by her grief. "I don't want to talk about this," she said. It's not going to happen. "I love you," he said. "I love you like the earth loves the earth. I need you to promise me this." "No. Promise me you'll put me in a home if I forget who you are." "No." He stood from the couch and walked across the room. He paused in the doorway to the kitchen and turned to face her. "Pretend," he said, "pretend this space between us is all we have left. Pretend I can't see or hear you across the distance. Pretend I have to introduce myself to you 30 times a day." Her eyes watered. She didn't want to cry. "Stop it," she said. "Why are you doing this?" "Just make the promise," he said. "Quit asking questions and just make the promise. I need the promise. Just be my wife and don't question my motives this time. Just accept it. Don't you love me enough to just accept something that I ask for?" She hid her face and sobbed. After a few minutes, she stopped. Then a few minutes after that, she could speak again. "Okay," she said. "If you can't remember who I am, then I'll put you in a home. But I'm going to visit you every day. I'll introduce myself to you every day for the rest of our lives." She rarely cursed, so he knew that she was telling the truth. "Damn you," she said. "Damn you for doing this to me. Damn you for being so f***ing sad." They were both 27 years old and lived in a one-bedroom house in the city. They'd been married for 3 years. She was pregnant with their second child. They'd known beforehand the gender of the first child, a daughter, but they decided to keep the gender of the second one a mystery. She was from the Colville Indian Reservation, and he from the Spokane Indian Reservation. Between their tribal lands flowed the Columbia River, the fourth largest in the United States. And during their 7 years of courtship, he'd drive his car onto the Gifford Ferry and cross the water for her. Oh, he'd loved that river since his birth. Oh, he'd loved her since the first time he'd seen her shawl dancing in the powwow twilight. But he'd always been afraid of his love's volume, and he'd always been more afraid of her love's volume. When he was 19, he'd driven onto the ferry, positive he was going to break up with her and join the Marines. Distraught by his weakness, he stepped out onto his car and paced the ferry's small deck. Then he leaned over the railing, and he saw a herd of deer swimming along the ship. "Holy sh-," he said to himself. He said again and counted 11 deer. "Holy sh-," he said for the third time, and the largest buck turned its head and looked at him. The deer was judging him. Amazed, he turned to tell the three other people on the ferry, but he changed his mind. He wanted to keep the deer for himself. It was a sign, he thought. How could he leave a place where he could see miracles like this? So instead of leaving her on that day and going to war, he carried his hand drum into her house, and with an audience of three, her and her parents, he sang an honor song to the deer. He improvised a song for deer, and as he sang it, he knew that his honor song was also a love song for her, and he'd instantly memorized it. So years later, as he stood in the kitchen doorway and watched his wife weeping over his ridiculous amendment of their wedding vows, he tried to comfort her. "Sweetheart," he said, "even if I forget your name, I'll still remember the deer song. Every time you come to visit me, I'll sing you that deer song, even if I'm not sure why I'm singing it, and everything will be okay." He almost believed it. And she almost believed it too.
Amber Tamblyn read Sherman Alexie's The Vow. I'm Jane Curtin. After a brief break, a steamy tale by Kate Chopin. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com. Delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at zabars.com/shorts. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. I'm Jane Curtin. For more information about the stories you're hearing, the readers who are reading them, or about the Selected Shorts writing contest, you can go to selectedshorts.org or wnyc.org/shorts. And please write and tell us what you think of today's program. Our next story is Joe Mino's People Are Becoming Clouds, in which a marriage is tested by atmospheric changes. One thing we should mention, for parents of younger children, is that this playful tale does include some references to sexual behavior. Mino's quirky tale was read by the quirky Kirsten Vangsness, a star of the hit television series Criminal Minds.
People are becoming clouds nowadays. Each time John goes to kiss his wife, Eleanor simply laughs politely into the palm of her hand and immediately turns into a puff of soft white vapor. The vapor is quite odorless and can assume various sizes and shapes. It can still understand when it is being spoken to, the vapor. It can understand whenever John begins wordlessly crying. One time, while holding hands at the airport, John, without thinking, kissed Eleanor's soft cheek, and immediately she turned into a puff of charming whiteness that resembled a young pony leaping over a fence post. It seemed that the pony was neighing from the way its long neck was stretched and raised. Someone took a picture of the cloud, and it ended up on the second page of the next day's newspaper. Eleanor's parents called right away. Her father was quite unhappy, while her mother seemed quite pleased. As a cloud of vapor, Eleanor will remain transparent for upwards of an hour or more. Her appearance may vary greatly depending upon various strange, unknowable factors, such as the weather, what she had eaten that day, and what she happens to be wearing, etc. When she is not a cloud of white smoke, Eleanor is a first-grade school teacher who is greatly loved by her students as well as almost everybody else, including strangers who pass her on the street. She is that type of striking young woman. She has short red hair and bright eyes like a pixie. She laughs the way you imagine a toy dog laughing. It should be noted that Eleanor had never turned into a cloud before the couple was married, and this unplanned development has been a source of silent frustration for John. A partial list of the strange shapes Eleanor has taken as a cloud of vapor: a dove with enormous wings blowing a large trumpet, an intricate snowflake with castles for feet, a swan with an impossibly long neck sewing a blanket, a fairly accurate representation of an angel with rings of spoons for a halo, and a gigantic apple being swallowed by a ghostly white tiger. Eleanor claims that turning into a cloud is totally beyond her control. John does not entirely believe this. Right before she transforms, she seems to be laughing, and her laughter is what leaves John unconvinced. But he refuses to argue about it. He loves her, and he thinks she loves him, and he believes it's just one of those things that will have to work itself out. Couples go through these kind of things, he thinks. John and Eleanor will sometimes try to be intimate. They will turn off the lights and put on some soft music. It will be maybe jazz music, sometimes not. John will lay there in their white bed and close his eyes and wait for his wife to touch his body. And when she does, he will try to stop himself from running his fingers through her hair. And he will be able to resist her for a little while. But if she is wearing the pink and brown nightgown, he will eventually grope at her, and within moments, she'll be drifting high above him. He will lay in bed then and stare up at her. A white cloud of happiness, condensing and expanding. He will reach his hands up to grab her, but he will be unable to. He will try to breathe her in, to take her into his lungs, but his face will only become red until, finally, he gives in. He will turn on his stomach and want to cry into the pillow, but he will not. He will be too embarrassed to cry. When he finally turns over, he will see Eleanor has become a snowy white falcon eating a peach. Or a series of lovely hills decorated with a miniature cloud town. He will wait, laying there in bed, and fumble with her discarded nightgown until she drifts back down. John will sometimes call Eleanor from his office where he works as an accounts representative for an aluminum company, and he will ask her, "Are you a cloud right now?" "No," she'll say laughing. "Of course not, honey." "What about now?" No. "What about now?" Other times, John will go on business trips to sad places like St. Louis and Cleveland. And he will call Eleanor from his motel room, and they will try and talk dirty, like they are only dating. "I'm climbing in the window and sneaking up on you," John will say. "I am dressed like an old-time bandit with a striped shirt and a mask." "Okay. What am I doing?" she will ask. "You are doing the dishes. You're wearing a white frilly apron, like a maid." "How about I'm wearing the apron, but I'm not a maid?" "Okay, that's good. You're doing the dishes in your apron, and I am sneaking behind you and touching your shoulders and arms and the back of your legs." "Then what?" she will ask. "I don't know. I'm carrying you off into my jet, and we are flying away now. I have kidnapped you, maybe." "You're a bandit with your own airplane?" "Yes, I'm independently wealthy. Chose a life of crime to relieve my boredom." "I see," she will laugh. "What are you doing to me now?" Someone will be listening to the television too loudly in the motel room next to his, and John will whisper into the phone softly, "I am blindfolding you. I am blindfolding you and feeding you a lot of frosting and candy." There will be a pause where John will be unsure if his wife has hung up or is still listening. And after some time, he will whisper, "Are you a cloud now?" And then there will be silence. There will only be the sound of air, which is no sound at all, which means, yes, she is a cloud now. And John will imagine kissing his wife right then, and he knows he will be unable to. So instead, he will kiss the phone, and it will be the closest thing he can get to the actual thing, the kissing of his wife. And then he will say goodnight and place the receiver back in the small plastic cradle before closing his eyes and fighting to go to sleep. The couple finds a weather/relationship specialist in the phone book and makes an appointment to go see him. He has glassy blue eyes and a white beard and holds Eleanor's hand. He has many charts and maps and graphs marking cold and warm fronts overlaid with sketches from an anatomy book. He blows his nose from a white handkerchief and asks the couple very personal questions like,
"How frequently do each of you masturbate?" And, "Do you still find your mate sexually attractive?"
John holds his hands over his eyes as he answers, feeling the heat of his embarrassment glowing along his eyelids. When, toward the end of the session, the specialist asks Eleanor her favorite shape when she is a cloud, and she responds, "I like just being the general kind of cloud the best." The old man nods and sets down his pen as if he has found the answer to something. He asks for a check for $75 and tells the couple to come back next week. They do not. They go to the movies instead. During the film, John boldly reaches for Eleanor's bare leg, kissing her with wild abandon, until suddenly she is an enormous black cloud, her gold earrings now strips of zigzag lightning. An usher sees the cloud and shines his flashlight at it, and John imagines the lightning flashing back as her smiling. At work, John finds himself searching the internet for clues, hints, suggestions, stories of similar weather-related problems happening to other normal red-blooded men. But no, there is nothing. There are only endless pictures of girls in wet t-shirt contests and sight after sight of affordable radar tracking devices which give three-dimensional depictions of storm clouds hovering above far-off cities. He comes across a photograph of a Gulfstream hurricane tearing the roof off a small white house and thinks he recognizes Eleanor as one of the clouds drifting in the nearby gray sky. He stares at the photo for a long, long time. Often, when Eleanor is a cloud, she will make a strange sound like this. Ooh. Eleanor sometimes phones John at work. Sometimes they talk while John is busy sorting through his files. "I want you to know that it's okay to be angry with me," Eleanor says. "I would be if it was the other way around." "I'm not angry with you," he says, typing something boring. "I know, but sometimes I wish you were. Sometimes I wish you would shout at me and tell me you hated me or something." John holds the telephone receiver against his chest. He feels as though he has fallen from a great height and is clutching at the air around him, only to find that the air is laughing spitefully. He stands up and watches the zipping rattle of the office around him and begins shouting, "I can't stand this anymore! I can't stand this!" He holds the phone above his head and howls and then places it against his ear again. "Eleanor," he breathes heavily. "Yes," she whispers. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry I yelled like that." "Do you feel any better?" she asks. "Yes," he says. "I guess I do." "Well, good. I'll see you when you get home." "Okay," he says. On the bus ride home, John fantasizes about the lips of various nondescript strange women. He imagines what he would do with a pair of hot lips if given the chance. He stares across the aisle, and a question forms from nothing in the vessel of his mind. Would I still love my wife so badly if she wasn't so impossible to claim? Would I still want her if I could have her whenever I wanted? He does not know. He isn't sure. He does not think so, suddenly. But maybe kissing her might be worth all the boredom in the world as well. When John arrives home from work, he finds Eleanor has become a large, sparkling building. She is as tall as a skyscraper and is made entirely of a strange, silvery material, like a cloud, both precious and transparent. The building is standing in the yard, rising high and mighty into the infinity of the evening sky like a futuristic needle. John sets his briefcase down and sighs, then takes off his jacket, folding it over his arm. Great, he says, looking up. This is just great. He finds the entrance to the large silver building, spins in through the revolving door, takes an elevator up to the highest floor, and stands staring out at the stars glowing above the rest of the horizon. The horizon is so big and dark and sad that John can barely lift his head. In the silence of that very great height, he can hear the echo of his own breathing. Eleanor? He asks, and then leans against the silver railing. Somehow he knows his wife is listening. He loosens his tie, taps once on the railing, and says, "It looks like you had a bad day."
Kirsten Vangsness read Joe Mino's People Are Becoming Clouds at the Getty Center in Los Angeles. Our final story is by the writer Kate Chopin, who lived from 1850 to 1904. She was rescued from polite oblivion by the feminist movement and is best known for her daring short novel, The Awakening. I got to read Chopin's lush story, The Storm.
The leaves were so still that even Bibi thought it was going to rain. Bobineau, who was accustomed to converse on terms of perfect equality with his little son, called the child's attention to certain somber clouds that were rolling with sinister intention from the west, accompanied by a sullen, threatening roar. They were at Friedheimer's store and decided to remain there till the storm had passed. They sat within the door on two empty kegs. Bibi was 4 years old and looked very wise. "Mama'll be afraid, yes," he suggested with blinking eyes. "She'll shut the house. Maybe she got Sylvie helping her this evening," Bobineau responded reassuringly. "No, she ain't got Sylvie. Sylvie was helping her yesterday," piped Bibi. Bobineau arose and, going across to the counter, purchased a can of shrimps, of which Calixta was very fond. Then he returned to his perch on the keg and sat stolidly holding the can of shrimps while the storm burst. It shook the wooden store and seemed to be ripping great furrows in the distant field. Bibi laid his little hand on his father's knee and was not afraid. Calixta at home felt no uneasiness for their safety. She sat at a side window sewing furiously on a sewing machine. She was greatly occupied and did not notice the approaching storm. But she felt very warm and often stopped to mop her face, on which the perspiration gathered in beads. She unfastened her white sack at the throat. It began to grow dark, and suddenly realizing the situation, she got up hurriedly and went about closing windows and doors. Out on the small front gallery, she had hung Bobineau's Sunday clothes to air, and she hastened out to gather them before the rain fell. As she stepped outside, Alcide Lavallière rode in at the gate. She had not seen him very often since her marriage, and never alone. She stood there with Bobineau's coat in her hands, and the big raindrops began to fall. Alcide rode his horse under the shelter of a side projection where the chickens had huddled, and there were plows and a harrow piled up in the corner. "May I come and wait on your gallery till the storm is over, Calixta?" he asked. "Come long in, Monsieur Alcide." His voice and her own startled her as if from a trance, and she seized Bobineau's vest. Alcide, mounting to the porch, grabbed the trousers and snatched Bibi's braided jacket that was about to be carried away by a sudden gust of wind. He expressed an intention to remain outside, but it was soon apparent that he might as well have been out in the open. The water beat in upon the boards in driving sheets, and he went inside, closing the door after him. It was even necessary to put something beneath the door to keep the water out. "My, what a rain! It's good 2 years since it rained like that," exclaimed Calixta as she rolled up a piece of bagging, and Alcide helped her to thrust it beneath the crack. She was a little fuller of figure than 5 years before when she married, but she had lost nothing of her vivacity. Her blue eyes still retained their melting quality, and her yellow hair, disheveled by the wind and rain, kinked more stubbornly than ever about her ears and temples. The rain beat upon the low, shingled roof with a force and clatter that threatened to break an entrance and deluge them there. They were in the dining room, the sitting room, the general utility room. Adjoining was her bedroom, with Bibi's couch alongside her own. The door stood open, and the room with its white monumental bed, its closed shutters, looked dim and mysterious. Alcee flung himself onto a rocker, and Calixta nervously began to gather up from the floor the lengths of a cotton sheet which she had been sewing. "If this keeps up, do you say if the levee's going to stand it?" she exclaimed. "What have you got to do with the levees? I got enough to do. And there's Bobino with Bibi out in that storm, if he only didn't left Friedheimer's." "Let us hope, Calixta, that Bobino's got sense enough to come in out of a cyclone." She went and stood at the window with a greatly disturbed look on her face. She wiped the frame that was clouded with moisture. It was stiflingly hot. Alcee got up and joined her at the window, looking over her shoulder. The rain was coming down in sheets, obscuring the view of far-off cabins and enveloping the distant wood in a gray mist. The playing of the lightning was incessant. A bolt struck a tall chinaberry tree at the edge of the field. It filled all visible space with a blinding glare, and the crash seemed to invade the very boards they stood upon. Calixta put her hands to her eyes and with a cry staggered backward. Alcee's arms encircled her, and for an instant he drew her close and spasmodically to him. "Bonté," she cried, releasing herself from his encircling arm and retreating from the window. "The house'll go next. If I only knew where Bibi was." She would not compose herself. She would not be seated. Alcee clasped her shoulders and looked into her face. The contact of her warm, palpitating body when he had unthinkingly drawn her into his arms had aroused all the old-time infatuation and desire for her flesh. "Calixta," he said, "don't be frightened. Nothing can happen. The house is too low to be struck, with so many tall trees standing about. There, aren't you going to be quiet? Say, aren't you?" He pushed her hair back from her face that was warm and steaming. Her lips were as red and moist as pomegranate seed. Her white neck and a glimpse of her full, firm bosom disturbed him powerfully. As she glanced up at him, the fear in her liquid blue eyes had given place to a drowsy gleam that unconsciously betrayed a sensuous desire. He looked down into her eyes, and there was nothing for him to do but to gather her lips in a kiss. It reminded him of Assumption. "Do you remember in Assumption, Calixta?" he asked in a low voice broken by passion. Oh, she remembered. For in Assumption he had kissed her and kissed and kissed her until his senses would well nigh fail, and to save her he would resort to a desperate flight. If she was not an immaculate dove in those days, she was still inviolate, a passionate creature whose very defenselessness had made her defense, against which his honor forbade him to prevail. Now her lips seemed in a manner free to be tasted, as well as her round white throat and her whiter breasts. They did not heed the crashing torrents, and the roar of the elements made her laugh as she lay in his arms. She was a revelation in that dim, mysterious chamber, as white as the couch she lay upon. Her firm, elastic flesh that was knowing for the first time its birthright was like a creamy lily that the sun invites to contribute its breath and perfume to the undying life of the world. The generous abundance of her passion, without guile or trickery, was like a white flame which penetrated and found response in depths of his own sensuous nature that had never yet been reached. When he touched her breasts, they gave themselves up in quivering ecstasy, inviting his lips. Her mouth was a fountain of delight, and when he possessed her, they seemed to swoon together at the very borderland of life's mystery. He stayed cushioned upon her, breathless, dazed, and enervated, with his heart beating like a hammer upon her. With one hand, she clasped his head, her lips lightly touching his forehead. The other hand stroked with a soothing rhythm his muscular shoulders. The growl of the thunder was distant and passing away. The rain beat softly upon the shingles, inviting them to drowsiness and sleep, but they dared not yield. The rain was over, and the sun was turning the glistening green world into a palace of gems. Calixta on the gallery watched Alcee ride away. He turned and smiled at her with a beaming face, and she lifted her pretty chin in the air and laughed out loud. Bobino and Bibi, trudging home, stopped without at the cistern to make themselves presentable. My BB, what will your mama say? You ought to be ashamed. You ought not put on those good pants. Look at them. And that mud on your collar. How you got that mud on your collar, BB? I never saw such a boy. BB was the picture of pathetic resignation. Bobineau was the embodiment of serious solicitude as he strove to remove from his own person and his son's the signs of their tramp over heavy roads and through wet fields. He scraped the mud off Bibi's bare legs and feet with a stick and carefully removed all traces from his heavy brogans. Then, prepared for the worst, the meeting with an overscrupulous housewife, they entered cautiously at the back door. Calixta was preparing supper. She had set the table and was dripping coffee at the hearth. She sprang up as they came in. "Oh, Bobineau, you back? My, but I was uneasy. Where you been during the rain? And Bibi, he ain't wet. He ain't hurt." She had clasped Bibi and was kissing him effusively. Bobineau's explanations and apologies, which he had been composing all the way, died on his lips as Calixta felt him to see if he were dry and seemed to express nothing but satisfaction at their safe return. "I brought you some shrimps, Calixta," offered Bobineau, hauling the can from his ample side pocket and laying it on the table. "Shrimps! Oh, Bobineau, you too good for anything!" And she gave him a smacking kiss on the cheek that resounded. Je vous réponds, we'll have a feast tonight, uh-huh. Bobineau and Bibi began to relax and enjoy themselves, and when the three seated themselves at table, they laughed much and so loud that anyone might have heard them as far away as La Valliere's. Alcide La Valliere wrote to his wife Clarisse that night. It was a loving letter full of tender solicitude. He told her not to hurry back, but if she and the babies liked it at Biloxi, to stay a month longer. He was getting on nicely, and though he missed them, he was willing to bear the separation a while longer, realizing that their health and pleasure were the first things to be considered. As for Clarisse, she was charmed upon receiving her husband's letter. She and the babies were doing well. The society was agreeable. Many of her old friends and acquaintances were at the bay. And the first free breath since her marriage seemed to restore the pleasant liberty of her maiden days. Devoted as she was to her husband, their intimate conjugal life was something which she was more than willing to forego for a while. So the storm passed, and everyone was happy.
That was my reading of Kate Chopin's The Storm. Thanks for joining me for Selected Shorts. Next week, knitting lessons from Amy Hempel and a revisionist version of a biblical story. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and was directed by Lou Antonio, Isaiah Sheffer, and B.D. Wong. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Jim Briggs III. Our guest commentator is Hannah Tinty. Our production intern is Malcolm Donaldson. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is David Peterson's That's the Deal, performed by the Deerdorf Peterson Group. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2012 by Tom Parada. Additional support has been provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the short story, the Henry Nias Foundation, the New York Community Trust's Program for Performing Arts Groups, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts has also been supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and with public funds from the New York State Council on the Arts. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at zabars.com/shorts. Support for this program comes from this station and public radio international stations nationwide, and from the PRI Program Fund. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.